and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Please stay in your seats to minimize distractions while our speaker is talking. Tonight's speaker is someone I've seen around since I first came in, and though it's been from afar, I've seen her go through big life events in sobriety, and that's always a wonderfully inspirational thing. So tonight we have Sarah.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Tim, for having me, for asking me, for your service work. This meeting was like a regular for me. I came to this meeting and sat back where that lady in the pretty blue shirt is sitting. I sat back there in my whatever I had on. I sat back there every Monday night, 8 o'clock, and listened to people talk about getting out from under this thing. And it really, really gave me a lot of hope. And I hope whatever I am going to say brings some hope to somebody sitting in this room tonight, because this is a place where the unexpected happened for me, and I would bet every single thing I have on the fact that it can happen for you too if you work these steps. So thank you, both Tims, for keeping the lights on and keeping this meeting going, because I know it has changed a lot of lives, and I really, really am so thankful for that. I'm sober. I've been sober since June 3rd, 2019. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other women, and we're just going to keep on doing that. Service has always been a big part of my sobriety. It's one of the first things that I really dove headfirst into. Like Alex mentioned, I have had some big life events. Their names are Liliana and Mariah, and they're fabulous. And I will use fabulous things. I will use wonderful, wonderful gifts as an excuse to sneak away from what I know works. And the crazy thing is, I didn't even realize that I was doing it. I didn't even, like, knowingly make the excuse, oh, well, this important thing is going on, so for that reason, I'm going to lay out of AA today, or I'm going to, you know, come up with some reason why I can't. I just slowly stopped. I just slowly stopped sponsoring effectively, and then stopped calling my sponsor, and then it had been so long, and I was like, oh, well, it's been a week, and I didn't drink, and I didn't die, so what's one more? And then was kind of coming to a meeting here or there, and maybe writing one or two inventories a week, maybe, if things were particularly bad. And then the next thing you know, I was insane. I was nuts. And I think I'm still kind of like shaking that off a little bit. You know, alcoholism isn't something that I've been rid of. It's still here. It's still very much a part of me and affects the way that I perceive the world around me, the way I process information. Like, my alcoholism is alive. And I can't believe that I was surprised by that, but I was. I just got back from the mountains. My husband and I took our little girls to the mountains for the long weekend, and there was this funny, like, recording playing about bears in the little place that we went for breakfast in the mornings, and they were saying, try not to surprise the bear, but don't let the bear surprise you. And I thought, yeah, that I have that. I do not want to surprise the bear, but I have let alcoholism surprise me. And it's sneaky. It's so sneaky. You know, I knew when I really needed to get back was when my husband came over and very lovingly was shredding some fresh Parmesan cheese on the dinner that I had cooked. And he got Parmesan cheese on the floor. And when I tell you, I was so mad about that Parmesan cheese on the floor for like 4 or 5 days. I was thinking about, oh, I'm so angry about that cheese on the ground. Instead of just like cleaning it up and moving on with my life, that is not the cheese. That is alcoholism. That's not my husband. That is alcoholism. And I knew I needed to really get back in here and do what I know works, because I've tried it the alternative way, and I know what happens to me. I have to continue to watch. I have to be on guard. I have to look out for the thing that I know wants me dead. I didn't always know that alcoholism wanted me dead. I didn't always know that I had this disease. I knew that my family had this disease. My grandma had like 46 years sober when she died, and my mom kind of
sort of got sober, didn't get sober, wanted to get sober again. She had a kind of a different situation. My mom was suffering from a disease, a weird syndrome called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and it makes your cartilage dislocate. And so she would just be in terrible pain from stuff like brushing your hair or walking upstairs a few too many times. It would make the cartilage, like, disintegrate. And she got put on some pretty heavy opiates, some pretty heavy drugs. And I guess you can kind of turn anybody into a drug addict if you feed them enough opiates. She started getting really mentally ill, and her alcoholism took off. And she never did get sober before she died. But the spiritual malady was definitely in her, and it was definitely in me, too. And I do remember feeling that. I didn't know that the name of it was a spiritual malady. But I do remember feeling like, not like I wasn't fitting inside of my skin. I remember feeling always like, isn't there more than this? Isn't there something else that I can have? Can't I have more? Can't I take more from this? Get more from this? Can't I feel better than this? Always. I remember always feeling that way. And then when I started drinking, heavy drinking, when I was about like 16 or so, I was from the very beginning a blackout drinker. From the very beginning, I would drink until I could not drink anymore because my arms stopped working because I blacked out and passed out. When I got here, I learned that a non-alcoholic will never black out. A non-alcoholic will physically pass out before they black out and keep walking around and doing whatever we're doing until they, you know, physically become incapacitated. I didn't know that. I had no idea. I thought that I was just, you know, hitting it hard or partying harder than the rest of the guys. It was just really kind of inexplicable. It doesn't make sense at all for someone to physically be able to consume that amount of alcohol and not have to go to the hospital. Hospitalizations came a little bit later on in my story. From the very beginning, would start drinking and not be able to control the amount that I take. And in the big book, that tells us that that is one of the conditions that makes me an alcoholic, right? And the other thing that would happen is anything would happen. And I would think about drinking. I would have anxiety about a paper that I had to turn in, and I would feel like I should take a drink about this. I would have an argument with someone, or a party I was going to, a celebration, a sad time, a nervous time, an anxious time, an excited time. Any time, my brain told me drinking would make this more, right? That's that thought that I can't get to be quiet. I guess the other part of this disease, I was taught, you know, that alcoholism is two parts, right? Alcoholism is what happens in my brain when I don't have a drink and what happens in my body when I do. It's a two-part disease that I've got. It's the mental obsession and it's the physical allergy, and I can't get out of it on my own. I can't. I tried everything. I tried going to treatment. Not just work to physically remove me from alcohol for a little while, but it didn't treat what I had going on the inside. I tried getting a new job, and that didn't work because they always seemed to be really crazy. Everyone around me always seemed to be such a jerk. I can't imagine the pattern there, the common denominator. But, yeah, I tried so many things. I tried dropping out of this school and going to that school, moving to California, coming back from California, going to South Carolina, coming home from there, all sorts of things. I tried reading religious books. I tried trying all sorts of different practices to try and relieve myself because I knew that I was in trouble. I knew somewhere deep down that I was separated from the woman that my creator designed me to be. And it hurt. It hurt all the time. Eventually, my drinking got to the point where I couldn't really get drunk anymore. I was just drinking, my friend Rusty called it, out of sick need. And I meant to say, too, I meant to nod at him, because today is actually the first anniversary of his passing. And one of the first things that he taught me when I was struggling with my conception of God or higher power or whatever it was, he said, don't worry about looking for that. He said, just start looking for the coincidences, baby. And I said, okay. And I did. And eventually I found so many that I stopped believing in coincidences. And I just have a feeling that this getting to speak tonight was not a coincidence at all. And I'm just feeling him with me all the time. So I'm thankful to get to be with you guys in
his, you know, one of his really special places on a special day. He told me, I guess I was probably talking about drinking and being in a lot of pain. And, yeah, I was. I was drinking out of sick need. That's right. And I couldn't get out from under it. I knew that drinking was causing me problems, but I couldn't imagine not having way bigger problems if I wasn't drinking, because drinking was my solution. It was my solution to everything. I tried to kind of dip my toes into AA at first. I had a probation officer that said I needed to come here and try this out, and so I did, but I didn't really, like, do it, you know. I just drank the coffee and ate your donuts. Like, where was this awesome part that I was just reading in step two? And I thought, yeah, that was me. I did that. Oh, it says right here, it says we had been asking something for nothing. The fact was we hadn't really cleaned house so that the grace of God could enter us and expel the obsession. Talking about that obsession to drink that I have. In no deep or meaningful sense have we ever taken stock of ourselves, made amends to those we had harmed, or freely given to any other human being without a demand for reward. And that was me. I just came in here and showed up like, hey, fix me. Doesn't this all revolve around me? And that didn't work. So I went back out and I drank more. It just got bad, y'all. It just got really, really bad. I ended up moving to California with this guy, the hardworking father of my sons. And he and I had two boys, Chandler and Miles, who are now 15 and 13, and they are fabulous, fabulous people. I really have to give that guy a lot of credit. I remember vividly standing up at this podium once before and calling him an entirely different name. And that's, it's so inappropriate. It's so inappropriate because he has worked really, really hard, and he has sacrificed a lot of himself to make sure that my sons had everything that they've needed for their whole lives. When I was selfishly drinking myself into oblivion with no remorse at the time, no consideration of anybody else or the impact I was having on them. And he sacrificed to take care of those guys, to take care of Chandler, to take care of Miles. And today I'm able to be really, really thankful for that. And that has not been an easy process. The perspective shift that we go through when we're doing this process is not an easy one, and it's not comfortable. This is not for the faint of heart by any means. I'm not going to say, oh, take it easy, does it, but do it, or whatever the thing, what's the sign on the wall? Take it easy, does it, but do it, or something like this. That's right. There's no taking, what's taking it easy is not what's going to get me well. It's not been my experience, because I tried it, like I said, and it didn't work. So we went to California, and my sons and I ended up leaving the hardworking father of my sons there and coming back to Atlanta. And I was raising them by myself for almost 2 years, and my alcoholism was so out of control, man. I was drinking for oblivion every night. It was the only way that I could survive. It was the only way I could survive. I had so much like guilt and shame and remorse and self-centeredness and was just so self-absorbed. There's a part in Bill's story where they talk about the remonstrances of his friends. And I related to that. I didn't have any friends left. The only people who were willing to hang around me, it was a transactional relationship with weird weirdos, like, at, you know, on some train tracks on back of Lawrenceville Highway. Sketchy. Not good stuff. Not good stuff. And I just knew I was in for trouble. I just knew that there was no way life was going to be able to continue like that. I don't even recall trying to ask for help that day. And you know what's so strange is nothing even particularly bad happened. Nothing even particularly crazy or insane happened that day. I just got drunk at 10:30 in the morning, like you do, and caused a massive, chaotic tornado at my parents' house, like you often do, and then took a big bottle of pills and a big bottle of whiskey and went into the bathroom and tried to just be done, man. I just wanted to get out of here. I pushed my son out the door. I called his godmother to come pick him up. I pushed my son out the front door, and I went upstairs to the bathroom. My sister's crying. My mom's downstairs screaming, and I didn't want to hear it anymore. I just didn't want to hear it, and it didn't work. So I got taken to the hospital and hospitalized, and it was a whole, they make a tremendous deal about stuff like that. I got out of there. They put you in the hospital again after the hospitalization, save your life hospitalization. Now they put you in the hospital, save your brain hospitalization. And those people were very well-meaning, and it didn't do the trick for me. Again, it was like I was just separated. I was just separated physically, but I still knew that I was wrecked. I still knew that my brain was the one making the decisions, and my brain was the one that 6 weeks ago said, I can't take this anymore. I'm finished. You know what I mean? How is the same brain going to fix the broken brain? I can't, that doesn't make any sense. I tried to get sober again after that, and it didn't really work. My son's father had to come pick them up while I was in the hospital. They don't let your kids come with you to rehab. So they had to get picked up, and they got taken to Virginia where he was stationed. He's in the Navy. He's been serving in our country's military for a long time now. And he had to come pick them up and took them back to Virginia. And that was it, man. That was really it. He let me come up and see him one time. I relapsed. It was horrifying. I can't believe I did that to my children. I am fully, fully trusting that what Stephen, was it Stephen? What he read for us in about the promises. There's a lot of promises, too, in the book, which is a fabulous, fabulous thing because I really like cool stuff. So when I read those promises, I get excited. And one of the ones that's in there is that we're going to see how our experience can benefit others. So I'm still trusting that that's going to come true and trying not to hold on to any regret about that trip. But when I think about relapsing, that gnarly of a relapse in front of my sons, it's hard not to still feel a little sting over that. You know, I caused a lot of harm the way I was drinking. And I'm so grateful to have the chance to work with other alcoholics who are still suffering today, in the hopes that maybe I'll be able to keep other families from having to experience that kind of pain, or at least play some small part. I went up to Virginia and came back, and I was still totally a mess. I wasn't getting sober. I wasn't doing anything for anybody else. I was still completely self-centered, self-absorbed, just trash can, just a soup sandwich trash can disaster. I couldn't hold on to a job. Every one of my relationships was in the tank. My father was so sick to death of me, he didn't know what to do with himself. I mean, I was really, really isolated in my drinking for a long time, and I felt like the loneliest person in the whole world. I did. I felt like the loneliest person alive. My sons and I had no contact with them. We were completely estranged, and that was so painful. I couldn't even speak their names out loud. I can't explain what happened. I, honest to God, have no idea what happened. I was supposed to be house-sitting, and the people who were entrusting me with their home said, oh, have a drink, relax, go to the pool, do whatever you want, just, like, make sure that nobody, you know, breaks in and steals all our shit or whatever. So I guess their interpretation of having a drink and my interpretation of having a drink are very different things. Because after I polished off two entire bottles of Meyer's Dark Rum by myself, I don't know what happened. I got home and was so sick. I was sick to death, man. And just puking all over the bathroom. I was so sick. And I went downstairs into my dad's kitchen to get, like, the spray cleaner to clean up the bathroom. And it's under the sink where a lot of cleaning products are, I guess. And I was bending over getting the cleaning product out of the bottom of the sink, and my dad saw these marks all over the back of my legs, these big handprints all over the inside of my thigh, all down the back of my legs. And he looked at me and he said, "What happened to you?" And I know that in that moment, he probably meant, "What happened to you? What are these bruises? Whose handprint is this on your leg?" But it felt in my heart like my dad was saying to me, "I don't recognize who you are. I don't recognize you. Who is this person?" And the sad fact is, I didn't recognize myself. I didn't know anymore. I didn't know how to answer that question. And not because I was too, you know, out of my mind drunk, just because I truly didn't know what had happened to me. I had no idea how I had gone from being a person who cared about my family, wanted to believe in God, wanted to make good friends and be a good friend, wanted to be a contributor and a giver and a lover, someone with good humor and a good work ethic. I had no idea how every single one of my ideals, every single value that I once held was just gone. Just gone, and I didn't know where it went. And that night, something changed. I don't know why, but I just got down on my knees, and I said, God, I don't know what you are, but if you're real, please give me the strength to be the woman that you created me to be. And the next day, I came in, I picked up a white chip, and I haven't had a drink since, and I'm really thankful for that. Yeah, getting, before I was sober, was a hell of a time, and since I've been sober, it's been a hell of a time, so I don't know, really, I mean, I know that I'm on the better side of things now, I know that's for sure, but that doesn't mean life is perfect. My brain still, I told you about the cheese, my brain still gets so wrapped up in how I think things should be that I forget that I don't know how things should be. I've got no idea how things should be. If you showed me a picture of my life 7 years ago, I would have been like, you have got the wrong girl. You have got the wrong girl. There's no possible way. I couldn't imagine being a person that would care about any of you. And now, there's some people sitting in this room that I hold more dear to me than anything I could even describe. It's crazy. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol when I got back here. I knew that once I started taking a drink, I couldn't not take another drink. And I knew that there was nothing in this world. No consequence, no reward, no family member, no judge, no probation officer, no police officer, no romantic relationship. Although there wasn't a lot of romance going on, but I mean, you know what I mean. There was nothing in the world that was going to stand in between me and one more. Once I take one, I can't not have number two. I can't not. I cannot not. And so I knew I had to just stay away from the first one. I knew that the only chance of survival against this thing was if I just didn't pick up drink number one. That's what it had to be for me. I got to not say you, that's what you've got to do, but for me, back then, and sometimes still, I got to not pick up that first one. You know, there's no problem that a drink is going to make better. Just don't wet it down. And then that gives me the opportunity to kind of get into the rest of the steps and actually get to some solution. There's another really good part that I was reading in here in the 12 and 12 and step 3 that was saying that step 3, like all the other steps, take affirmative action. Steps 3 through 12, affirmative action. So that lets me know if I'm just sitting around thinking about it and talking about it and lecturing about it, then I'm not really doing it, right? Doesn't it say, who read for us? You read for us, Megan. You read for us. Here are the steps we took. Not here are the meetings we went to. Not here are the people we smoked cigarettes with in the parking lot. It says, here are the steps we took. Right? I knew that my life was unmanageable. I knew I wasn't going to be able to all of a sudden start managing it just because I wasn't drinking gin and tonics this big for breakfast. So I just let that up. I just said, whatever, it's not manageable. I don't know if I'm going to ever be able to manage it, so I'm just not going to think about that right now. I'm just going to think about not taking that first drink and keep on showing up. And that is what I did, man. That is what I did. And I didn't really have like a step two experience, to be very honest with you, because when I was out there, I had already come to believe, like we were talking about what it says on page 25, we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it, and we saw in y'all that something was happening. Something was really working, but I was only able to see that something was able to really work because I showed up. If I'm at my home being sad about not drinking, I'm not able to see it working in these shiny, happy people. So I have to come here so I can see that happening. And then I was like, oh, boy, now kind of the hopelessness and futility of my own stuff is really glaring. It's really, really big, you know. I'm not an alcoholic who got here and stopped drinking and then things got better. I got here and stopped drinking and things got worse. I all of a sudden wasn't able to numb down that pain of missing my sons. I wasn't able to numb down the pain of being so far alone that I didn't feel like I had like a real, like a close loving relationship with anybody. You know, my dad didn't really want anything to do with me. My mom had already passed away. Neither one of my sisters wanted to talk to me. I mean, it took a while. It took a lot of action and a lot of new living to show these people that something was different inside of me. And so I just kind of came and kept on doing the best I could. It took me a long time before I went through the steps with a competent sponsor. I was showing up. I was here at this speaker meeting. I was going to book studies. I was listening to Joe and Charlie on tape. I was in every single service position. And when there wasn't any more, then I invented some. I planned a retreat. I dragged a bunch of you guys up to the mountains. I was like, God, like trying so hard. But it's like a little less this and a little more that, right? I mean, that's what it's got to be. And I didn't learn that until I actually did the steps. I was saying all the right things. I was going to a gazillion meetings. I was like in every single service position I could think of. And still, when I'm driving up, this is when they were doing that construction on 400. And I used to just think about driving that Lexus straight into those big cement beams, because I just was like, what is going on? I'm not drinking. I'm going to meetings. Why do I want to die? Why do I feel so miserable? And it was because I didn't have a solution that worked yet. I hadn't gone through the steps. I hadn't gone through the steps, and I hadn't had a spiritual awakening, and I still had so much self full of it. Just the channel was still completely blocked. It talks about how we have to do the work to clear that channel out and that we can't do it on our own. So when I finally found the person who was willing to do the work with me and sit down and say, okay, all your garbage, put it on a piece of paper. We're going through it and we're going to sort it out. And that's exactly what we did. She said, put them in order from most important, most absolutely burning the house down right now to would be nice if we got it solved. And that's what I did. And in my brain, it seemed so magnificent. It seemed like it was going to be the longest list that there ever was in the history of lists. And I put it on paper, and it was like 11 things. It was like not that many things at all. And so, you know, we sorted through it as best we could and said, all right, well, we got two options here. You can keep on running the show, or you can give it up. And then we did a little comparative analysis of how things go when I run the show, and I promptly decided, not that. Let's go the other way. So that was really the moment where I was like, I'm not going to be alone in giving it up to God. Like, I can't be the only person who was ever afraid of surrender. There has got to be other people who were afraid of surrender. And I started talking, I started asking, because I do my research, and I was right. Nobody, it turns out, likes the leveling of their pride, the confession of their shortcomings, all of the other things that this process requires for its successful consummation. It says none of us like that. So I'm not alone. This is not just about me. This is not about me feeling better. This is not about me getting well. This is about me sorting through the stuff of the past, learning the important stuff from it, and hurry up and get it together so that I can turn around and help somebody else. Because that's where the juice is, man. That's where the lights come on. I'll tell you one thing. It's really cool not blacking out every day, being able to hold down a job, having people believe you when you tell them it's raining outside. Like, that kind of stuff is awesome. And the cash and prizes are cool, too. But what is really, really solid is seeing a person that you met crying on the side of a curb outside of a shady AA house, crying on the curb, talking about, I'm fine. Seeing that lunatic get her dog back and get her own apartment and get her first car, that is the juice. That is the juice. That's not something that happens just on my own. That's not something that's just between me and God. That's the way that God uses other people in my life to show me his miraculous, redemptive love. And that is crazy. That's mind-blowing. And another thing that I think is so cool, while I'm at it, while I've got the microphone, I'm going to tell you something else I think is so cool. And that is that it keeps going. You know, it says in the book, it talks about it a lot in the beginning of the book, in those first, like, 2 and 3 chapters that we all love so much. It talks a lot about how we begin to see results. This, we commenced to get results, right? If only we begin to look and, what is it? Look and feel, seek, look, feel. I think I'm getting mixed up from 2 different paragraphs in the 12 and 12, because when I was reading it, I remember going, oh, they say, look and find, and then seek and listen. I'm going to just quit while I'm behind, you know. They talk over and over again about how this is just the beginning. Like, doing all of this really, really painful work, clearing the channel out so that we can have a space for our Creator to enter into our hearts and minds in a way that is indeed miraculous. That takes work, and that's painful, and it's just the beginning. It's just the beginning. Being able to not drink one day at a time is cool, but it's just the beginning. And that's been my experience. Like I said, with climbing up the mountain with my boys, trying to get them back, trying to just get in contact with them, trying to get their phone number, trying to just have an address that I could send a birthday card to. How many times do you listen to me whine and cry about this address? Up a mountain, I tell you, more than a decade I was separated from my boys. And this summer they came and stayed at my clean, sober house with me in the room that my husband and I redid for them with bunk beds. And they were here with us for like 2.5 weeks, and we had the best time just like literally walking around and going to the grocery store and being at the farmer's market and watching movies on the couch and all of those moments that I longed for that I was sure I would never be able to get back, I got to have. And it's not just in the crazy spring break trip that we got to take them on and the amazing visit that we had. It's like in the small things. It's in my son unpromptedly sending me his class schedule for his sophomore year in high school. Like, that's crazy that I get to have a relationship with them like that today. And like I said, like, the cash and prizes are nice. It's fun to have a car that works. It's nice to know that the lights are going to turn on in my clean, sober, loving home. When I go flip the light switch, the electricity comes on. Sick, very awesome. I've got 2 beautiful, beautiful girls. I've got a dog. He's a good boy. He's a good boy, trapped in a bad dog's body, but he's a good boy, and I love him. And I couldn't have that, you know what I mean? My dog was sick and dirty and tired when I was drinking. He was a good boy, too, Pork Chop, but he was sick, you know, and tired. This dog gets brushed. This dog eats cheese. He has little CBD, that expensive stuff you told me about, droplets on his foods. I mean, it's not... Like, that kind of stuff is cool. But I was thinking about, like, how amazing it is, like, cooler than the stuff itself. The fact that I was trusted by the thing that created it all, the fact that I was trusted by God to take care of these little, all of it, the kids, the husband, the dog, the house, the car, like, the fact that me, I was trustworthy to take care of this stuff is crazy. That is a mind-blowing thing to me. You know, I'll never get over that, I hope. I'm trying to stay green, because green things grow, you know. So, I just try to keep it up. For me, a really important tool is the 10-step inventory. And I know people go, oh, Sarah, and she's so strict, and she's na-na-na, and she brings her big book to all the meetings. And I get, like, made fun of because of that. But whatever, dude. If you had what I have and you knew that the answers were in that book, you sure as shit would be carrying that book around, too. I'm sorry, Tim. You surely would be carrying that book around, too. If you had what I had and you knew that the answer, the way to solve it, the way to feel good was in that book, you'd be carrying it with you, too, man. You'd be carrying it with you, too. And it still does kind of creep back up. That same insanity that made me think that having a drink was a great idea, it comes back. It comes back up. Not in the form of, I should have a drink. Not in that way. But it comes back in this voice that goes, I can't believe he said that to me. It comes back and says, the nerve of her to speak to me like that. That's the way it comes back to me. And I've got to be on lookout for it. And my 10th step does help me do that. It helps me think about the way that I'm thinking so that I can identify areas where there is still room for growth. Because that's what I want. I want to keep on getting bigger and I want to keep on getting better. I like cool stuff. I want to see more of it. And the way that I can do that is to keep self out of the way so that God can come in. Because God has such bigger, better, cooler, more interesting, more fabulous plans than I could ever come up with. And I have to get rid of self so that that power can come in. Because it'll never get better if it's just me with me. It'll never get better. So I have to kind of keep a list of these things because it just... it keeps on coming back, and I want to keep an eye on the things that I'm still holding on to that are blocking me from it. The stuff that I think is a really good idea or really important, or that thing that I better just make sure I say, that's the kind of stuff that I want to be on lookout for, you know. Like Lily, I was going to tell you, this girl, man, she is so, that's my girl, man. She is so, I am so like her. We were at the mountain, and the place that we went to have breakfast was, like, kind of midway up the mountain, and there was this big biking trail with acorns all over the side of it. So while we were waiting for my husband to finish doing whatever he's doing, probably paying or something, I don't know, whatever he was doing, we would go outside, and we would have acorn races, and we would pick up all the acorns and then roll them down the hill. And she would say, ready, set, go, and she'd roll it down the hill, and it's so cute. And I showed her, like, you can pick up more than one acorn at a time. So now she's picking up all the acorns. She got all the acorns in her hands. And I said, let me hold the acorns, and then you can just roll them one at a time. And she didn't want to let me hold the acorns. She wanted to hold all the acorns in her hands. She wanted to keep a hold of everything that she thought she needed, and everything that she had, she wanted to keep it. But she couldn't roll the acorns down anymore because her hands were too full of the stuff she thought that she needed. So she's sitting there trying to just let one acorn go at a time. She can't do it. She can't do it. She can't, like, let go of what she thinks she needs so that she can do the thing that she really wants to do. And I love her, and I want her to be happy, and I want her to have the best time. So I'm like, let me hold the acorn. No. She can't do it. Can't let go of what she thinks she needs, because she thinks that her plan is better than my plan. And isn't that it? I mean, isn't that so it? That's exactly what I do. God, yes, come into my life. Expel the obsession to drink. Please, God, do it. Make me not want to drink anymore. And while you're at it, make me a nicer person, too. Make me a nicer person. Make me happier. Make me more joyful. Make me more excited. Make me. And it's like not it. That hasn't been the experience for me that has been most effective. For me, the experience that I've had that's really worked is when I pray like, God, I'm not asking for a lighter load. I'm asking for a stronger back. God, please put the person in my path that needs help and let me see something cool happen with it. God, please direct me to the person who needs my help, the way that you would have me be. And it's so cool. It's so cool the way God does what he does, because I never know what to expect. Like, just for a small example, I was talking to a sponsee a while ago and talking about, you know, clearing out the channel so that we can have that conscious contact with God come through. And I was telling her about a time that I had this thought, you should give some money away. Like, I heard it clear as a bell in my mind, you should give some money away. And she said, well, how do you know that wasn't just you talking to yourself? And I said, because I talk to myself all the time, and I would never tell myself to give money away. I never would do that. But the way that God uses our willingness to do his will instead of ours is incredible when we get out of the way. There was a few weeks ago, I went online on Central Office. This was right after the cheese incident. And I was like, this is crazy. I got to do something here. And I was going to get on a Zoom meeting. And so hopped on the Central Office website, which is so useful and really impactful. Thank you, Central Office, for all you do. I found a Zoom meeting, random ass Zoom meeting. And I hopped on there, thought, oh gosh, I don't love Zoom meetings, but we'll see what happens, right? And I got on and we were reading a random story out of the back of the book. And I thought, how great could this be? I'm sitting on my computer looking at people, can't even have a hug or a cup of coffee, and I'm reading about a story that I don't care about, and all of a sudden I got into it, and I'm like, wow, this is really smart. This person's experience is a lot like my experience. And by the end of the story, I was so impacted that I was ready to share about it. And so I waited my turn, and then I did my share. And after the meeting, this girl reached out to me. She texted me. I put my phone number on Zoom in case something like this is about to happen. She texted me from out of the blue, and she said, hey, my name's Kim, which was my mom's name. And she said, I really liked your share. And I said, oh, no kidding. How cool is that? And thanks so much. And she said, I've been looking for a sponsor. Can I talk with you sometime? And I said, yeah, sure. How about tomorrow night at 7 o'clock? And we got on the phone, and she started telling me a little bit about her story. And I said, so what's the deal? You know, what's up? How'd you drink? Were you an alcoholic? What's going on? And she went, wah, 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 and said all kinds of stuff. And I said, okay, okay. And she got to this part about her experience, and she said, well, the truth is, I got so out of hand with my drinking that I tried to commit suicide. And while I was hospitalized, the custody of my sons went to my ex-husband. And you could just hear the pain and the shame in this girl's voice. And I know it well because I lived it. I had that same crack in my voice for a very long time. I had that same coat of shame over me, that same kind of inability to look you in the eyes over me. I had that for a long time. And this whisper in your mind that goes, if they know who I really am, they're not going to want to know me. They're going to kick me out of here. And she said, my ex-husband got custody of my kids. I haven't talked to my boys in more than a decade. I've been trying really hard to find a lawyer that can help me with this case. And the truth is, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I said, oh, no kidding, me too. And she said, what? And I said, yeah, me too. I can help you. And so far, so good, man. She's been calling every day. She's been doing her stuff in the book. Today's her 30 days sober, which is the longest time she's had sober in the last decade. So that's crazy. And I hope I never run out of amazement at what God has done in my life, because it's a real honor to be used in this way. It's a real honor to have had the shift in perspective that makes me thankful for all the pain that I've walked through, because you guys have shown me how to use it as a gift. And I just don't think that'll ever be not so cool. So I'm going to keep on coming here. I hope you will too. And I really appreciate you guys giving me the chance to share.
Thank you, Sarah.
First I slip and then I quit to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise. Thank you. Take me where the promise is.